Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Al-Shabaab attacks a Somali presidential palace, and Muslim fighters attack a CAR church and 22 are killed. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Gunmen have attacked Somalia's presidential palace in Mogadishu, with some making their way inside the walls. Reuters news agency quotes a spokesman for the militant group Al-Shabaab as claiming responsibility for the attack. A spokesman said Al-Shabaab fighters have captured some parts of the palace. Witnesses report hearing gunfire inside the compound. However, there's no immediate word on the whereabouts of President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud. More than 20 people, meanwhile, are dead in the Central African Republic after Muslim fighters attacked a church sheltering thousands of civilians. Witnesses say Seleka rebels attacked St. Joseph's Cathedral late Monday in the town of Bambari after accusing the church of protecting Christian anti-Balaka militiamen. A source at the Bambari hospital tells VOA's French to Africa service that 22 people were killed. After the attack, the French defense minister canceled a visit to the town that was planned for today. The death toll from the West African Ebola outbreak has climbed to 518. The World Health Organization says 37 deaths attributed to Ebola were reported late last week in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Those are the three countries where the disease has been confirmed. The WHO says the total number of Ebola cases in West Africa stands at 844. The defense for South African runner Oscar Pistorius has rested in its case in its murder trial, leaving only closing arguments before the judge decides his fate.
And with that in mind, then, we close the case for the defense.
Yes, Mr. Nell, we've come to the end of the defense case.
Indeed, m'lady.
Meanwhile, the judge has adjourned the trial until August 7th and 8th, when the court will hear final arguments. Australia's High Court has blocked an attempt to return more than 150 asylum seekers to Sri Lanka. They were intercepted more than a week ago near Christmas Island. Phil Mercer reports.
Lawyers have argued that it would be illegal for Australia to transfer 153 mostly ethnic Tamil asylum seekers to the Sri Lankan Navy. Their vessel was intercepted more than a week ago near Christmas Island, a remote Australian territory in the Indian Ocean. Those on board had reportedly fled persecution in Sri Lanka and travelled to a refugee camp in India, then boarded a vessel to Australia. Advocates expressed concern the refugees will be mistreated or imprisoned if they're forcibly repatriated. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
Israel has launched dozens of air raids on the Gaza Strip today as it edged closer to a ground invasion to halt Palestinian rocket attacks on Israel. The Israeli defense chief Moshe Yaalon said the Jewish state is prepared for a campaign against Hamas militants in Gaza. The Israeli president Shimon Peres says his country has no choice but to respond to the Hamas rockets fired into southern Israel.
Israel left Gaza willingly, and they could have a free and open life. Instead, they are shooting at our children, at our mothers, at our civilians. What for? We cannot compromise with death. We cannot compromise with rockets. We cannot compromise with this sort of a behavior. And we shall stop them.
Meanwhile, a Hamas spokesman vowed that Palestinians would resist an Israeli advance. Russian news agencies say President Vladimir Putin has asked Russian lawmakers to revoke the right they had granted for Russian forces to intervene in Ukraine. The report said that President Putin issued the request to the upper house of parliament today. Late on Monday, U.S. President Barack Obama urged Mr. Putin by telephone to help implement Ukrainian leader Petro Poroshenko's plan for easing political tensions, starting with the ceasefire declared on Friday. U.S. President Barack Obama is preparing to ask Congress for $2 billion to address an immigration crisis that has seen tens of thousands of unaccompanied children from Central America cross illegally into the United States. The emergency spending request is expected to be made today and would cover detention facilities, legal needs, and border enforcement, among other things. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
I was a young Afrikaner girl whose views and mindset were changed by the greatest statesman of our time. Yet to me, he was more than my moral conscience. I had learned to care for him because he cared for me.
That's Zelda Lagrange, personal secretary to the late President Nelson Mandela. Details coming up. Also in the news, the Nigerian military says it is moving closer to rescuing the more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped in April. And there are reports of heavy explosions and gunfire at the presidential palace in Mogadishu today. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Kenya, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. In our top story tonight, the Somali service of the Voice of America reports explosions and heavy gunfire at the presidential palace in Mogadishu today. Witnesses report black smoke rising from the palace. 16 people have reportedly been killed. News sources say militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility. Sources say President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud is at the headquarters of the African Union mission to Somalia elsewhere in the city. Somali ministers told a VOA reporter by phone that they are trapped inside the palace. The Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab lost control of Mogadishu in 2011, but continues to attack locations in the capital. The Islamist militants have waged an insurgency against the reconstruction of the government of Somalia for a decade. After several arrests and reported victories against the Boko Haram militants, the Nigerian military says it is moving closer to rescuing the more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped in April. But as Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja, critics are skeptical, saying the government is under enormous pressure to demonstrate action and that military might alone will not end the insurgency.
If fighting insurgents was a sport, the Nigerian government would appear to be on a winning streak. Nigeria's military says in recent days its fight against Boko Haram insurgents has gained momentum after forces completely rooted out militants from some forest areas in the northeast. Nigerian National Information Center coordinator Mike O'Meri says President Goodluck Jonathan is doing everything he can to save the kidnapped girls, and recent arrests have brought the military closer to a rescue.
He is working assiduously to ensure the rescue and safety of these children. He is also working hard to ensure that peace returns to all parts of this country.
The military reports arresting, among others, one of the masterminds of the abduction, recruiters for the newly identified female wing of Boko Haram, and two foreign mercenaries. The military also reports killing at least 97 terrorists and losing 12 soldiers, including an officer. O'Meri says vigilante groups and average citizens are partially responsible for the recent success.
Citizens have joined the call for the president to intensify effort at finding a solution to the issue of insecurity in the northeast, particularly with reference to the rescue of our girls.
But in the past week, the U.S.-based Council on Foreign Relations reports insurgents have killed at least 134 people. Also, more than 60 women who were kidnapped in mid-June escaped Boko Haram on their own. Critics say the wave of reported military activity could simply be posturing in response to local and international pressure to show they are doing what they can to save the girls. Pastor Johanna Buru heads the Peace, Revival and Reconciliation Foundation of Nigeria.
Government are only beaten about the bush. I know why I'm saying this, because they've tried it the other way wrong, and now we're seeing the repercussion.
Buru calls for peace talks, saying battling Boko Haram with military power alone simply increases the body count without addressing the problem. He says northeastern Nigeria, where the insurgency began 5 years ago, is a region packed with unemployed, impoverished, angry young people who feel their government has long abandoned them. Ultimately, Burrow says neither the government nor the insurgents will ever truly win the fight. With thousands of people killed this year alone, northeastern Nigeria's economy and infrastructure in shambles, and hundreds of schoolchildren missing, and hundreds more dead, in the end, he says, everyone loses. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says the death toll of migrants trying to reach Europe by crossing the Mediterranean continues to rise. The UNHCR says 12 bodies have been recovered in the latest tragedy, which occurred when a boat overturned soon after departing from Libya. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The victims of this tragedy include a Syrian mother and her two small children, three Eritrean nationals, and six other Africans of undetermined nationalities. The UN Refugee Agency says it was informed about the accident on Monday, although the boat capsized off the coast of Tripoli on Sunday. It says the boat, which was meant for 200 passengers, was probably carrying many more people than it could hold. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says search and rescue operations to find possible survivors or to recover the bodies of other victims are continuing. He says it is likely other people aboard the ship may have perished.
UNHCR applauds the search and rescue operations being run by government authorities, but asks that such operations are further strengthened, particularly in areas with high concentrations of boat crossing. We're urging states worldwide to look at providing legal alternatives to dangerous sea journeys. These might include family reunification, speeded resettlement, and humanitarian admissions. Governments are additionally being encouraged to resist punitive or deterrent measures, including detention for people seeking safety.
The UNHCR reports more than 500 people have lost their lives this year while crossing the Mediterranean. This includes 217 people believed to have drowned off the Libyan coast and at least 288 others confirmed dead or missing from boat accidents in the waters off Italy, Turkey, and Greece. Italian authorities say 64,000 migrants have arrived on their shores since the start of the year. The Italian government has asked other European nations for help in coping with the influx. Meanwhile, the UN Refugee Agency says it has registered nearly 37,000 asylum seekers and refugees in the Libyan cities of Tripoli and Benghazi. It says Syrians make up the largest group, followed by Eritreans, Somalis, and Iraqis. It says many asylum seekers live in precarious conditions, but that many will risk their lives on the perilous Mediterranean crossing in a desperate bid to find refuge from wars and persecution, and in some cases, poverty and unemployment. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thirteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. This week, South Sudan marks its third year of independence, yet the oil-rich country finds itself at war between supporters of President Salva Kiir and his former vice president, Riek Machar. Peace talks in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa have produced ceasefires that have failed to stick. And the Fund for Peace has listed South Sudan at the top of its fragile states index. Linda Bishai is a senior program officer at the Center for the Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington. Reporter William Eagle asked her if the country's declaration of independence 3 years ago came too soon.
There was concern at the time that independence was declared, but also in understanding that the momentum and the desire for independence was quite strong, and perhaps it would have been unproductive to try to slow it down at the time. Hindsight is 20/20. I think there were things that could have been done more effectively to deal with some of the warning signs that were noticed. It was obviously known that there were tribal differences, but more importantly, political differences that had not been resolved in the new political structure. The fact that it was a single party state for all intents and purposes, the opposition parties were minuscule and weak. was of great concern. Nonetheless, other countries have fared better with less. I think there was also this understanding that it had wealth because of its oil, and that would sort of help it muddle through until it could get its political affairs in order. You know, there were definite areas of concern at the time that South Sudan voted on and then declared its independence, but they had to be balanced against what had been many, many, many years of struggling to achieve some kind of autonomy, and struggling against a Khartoum government that had really could have done more, to be frank, to make unity attractive.
What were some of the political differences that were left unresolved then and perhaps are exacerbating things today? And I assume these were differences that perhaps existed under the Comprehensive Peace Agreement and perhaps were not settled, or not enough effort was made towards settling them during that era?
The Comprehensive Peace Agreement, although hailed as a fantastic advance at the time and an important way to stop the violence and stop the civil war and create some kind of cooperation between the Southern Sudanese and the government of Khartoum, did have some pretty significant flaws. One amongst them was the absolute failure to address the crimes of the civil war, to kind of start healing and reconciliation processes, and that's in the South, amongst the Southerners, as well as the relationship between North and South. And I guess that was just considered a bridge too far, an issue too complicated, and it continues to be extremely complicated, both for Sudan and South Sudan. Issues of impunity and accountability for both governments are very serious. And I know that the African Union is considering, they've got a special commission investigating crimes in the most recent round of violence, and they're considering possibilities of a hybrid tribunal to deal with some of the most recent crimes. But frankly, the impunity goes way back throughout North and South Sudan for many years. So that's one of the key flaws. Another one perhaps was this assumption that the army and the political wing, the SPLA and the SPLM, Sudan People's Liberation Movement, would somehow just transition from having been a very effective fighting machine to an effective political structure, and that it would somehow sort of naturally give up some of its party power to create a democracy in South Sudan. And that's a tall order for a group of people who are considered or consider themselves national heroes of the war and of the struggle for liberation and independence. And so some of what we're seeing now, frankly, is a kind of a grab for a turn, if you will, amongst the leaders of that struggle to say basically, look, you've had your turn, it's my turn now, in very simple terms, but also a failure to have that political transformation, which is difficult under the best of circumstances, let alone under the challenging circumstances that South Sudan was faced with.
What are some of the challenges, short-term, immediate challenges, say within the next 6 months to a year?
Well, short-term challenges are going to be getting incentives in place that get the two primary instigators, the president himself and the SPLM in opposition led by Riek Machar, some incentives to get them to stop their efforts to solve their dispute militarily. That is going to be difficult. That short-term goal is actually, that's not so difficult. What's difficult is then how to make that short-term goal transition smoothly into a middle-term goal, which would involve reconciliation amongst the tribes and accountability of the crimes. And so offering the incentives to the leaders to stop their fighting and resolve the situation politically is going to interfere with that longer middle-term goal of providing recognition of the crimes that were committed and some form of justice for the victims. And also some sense of national purpose and national identity to be recaptured, right? So it's also important to remember that much of the country has not been involved in this violence, although we're beginning to see very worrying signs that states that had been peaceful and had been uninvolved are getting pulled into it. And that's why it's very important to stop it quickly before those uninvolved states are in fact pulled into it.
That was Linda Bishai of the U.S. Institute for Peace in Washington. She was talking with reporter William Eagle. Two opposing rebel factions in a year-long sectarian war in the Central African Republic, CAR, postponed preliminary talks scheduled for July 7th. This after SELECA leaders failed to settle internal leadership disagreements. Leaders of anti-Balaka forces were to meet SELECA yesterday for discussions in Bangui in advance of peace talks to be held in Brazzaville, the Republic of Congo, later this month. French Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian says the conflict remains complex and fragile, but France hopes regional talks will proceed as scheduled. Meanwhile, rebels and armed Muslim civilians conducted a grenade attack yesterday on Saint Joseph Cathedral in Bambari. More than 4,000 Christians had sought refuge in the compound. Church officials say many have died but offered no detail. The town is 230 miles north of the capital and serves as SELECA headquarters. CAR President Catherine Samba Panza promotes a political settlement but is not able to lead the country to peace, says Le Drian. France is hopeful regional leaders will be more successful bringing the rebel groups to a settlement in the Brazzaville meetings. Thousands have died and more than 1 million have fled their homes in a year of sectarian conflict. Most are Muslims fleeing into northern zones closer to Chad and Sudan. In September, 10,000 UN peacekeepers are expected to replace 8,000 peacekeepers from France and the African Union. In Zimbabwe, Movement for Democratic Change leader Morgan Tsvangirai has called for a national dialogue. Tsvangirai tells VOA reporter Blessing Zulu that the country is on the wrong path 1 year since the last presidential election.
The general feeling of despondence is arising out of the fact that it's a year since the last election and the things are appearing to be going down. The poverty is increasing, unemployment is increasing, and they're wondering what is the solution. And sometimes you listen to those kind of comments and you feel the national responsibility of the national crisis. So one of the suggestions that's emerging from the people is that there needs to be dialogue. And I think there is an emerging consensus on the need of people to sit down as Zimbabweans to resolve this issue.
This national dialogue that you are referring to, is this the second coming of the Mugabe Tsvangirai GNU?
No. I think let me give it to you that, first of all, in the face of a national crisis, the people in that country must sit down and find a solution. In this case, it's no longer something that is initiated by outsiders. Is something that is necessary for Zimbabwe, for the solution of the Zimbabwean crisis. So that's the first objective. The second objective is to learn lessons from the first negotiated GPA. The lesson fundamentally is that we put in a government over a wrong structure. Instead of dealing with ZANU-PF hegemony, to dismantle ZANU-PF hegemony and its institution and set a new system, we just put a government which failed to produce the necessary reforms because ZANU-PF remained adamant on the question of reforms. Lastly, I think what is important is that this time around, it's not just the political elites that should sit down and talk over what needs to be done. I think we need to expand the stakeholders. And one of the things that is there is that we don't need outsiders. I think we've worked together for the last 4.5 years. Why can't we sit down, agree on a platform and agenda that will resolve the crisis that we face as a country?
But some hardliners in ZANU-PF have clearly stated that they are not keen on dialogue.
Well, what solution do they have except to retain power? And that's the danger of those that will define themselves as hardliners. Hardliners to maintain power without legitimacy is not going to solve the problem of this country.
You say in your statement Mr. Mugabe is marooned from reality. Do you think he is not aware that Rome is on fire?
If he is aware of what's taking place, has he ever responded to it, or he has actually added the fuel to fire? Has he ever done anything about it? No. Has he tried to give us some direction as to how he hopes to resolve the economic crisis? No. So we all face the consequences of President Mugabe's lack of political initiative and paralysis.
That was Zimbabwe opposition leader and former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai speaking from Harare with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service. Zelda Lagrange worked for the late Nelson Mandela for nearly two decades, serving as his secretary, gatekeeper, and as one of his closest confidants after he was elected the first black president of South Africa in 1994. In her newly released self-penned memoir, she describes how South Africa's liberation hero became the epicenter of family feuds in the final years of his life. Gillian Parker has the story from Johannesburg.
And good morning, Mr. Mandela. Zelda Lagrange writes about her journey serving the man she calls Hulu, or grandfather. She takes readers from her awkward start to what she says became a bitter end within his inner circle during the final months of his life. Lagrange grew up in South Africa, a white Afrikaner who supported the segregation of the races under apartheid. "We were, I suppose, racists," she writes. In this passage, read by a South African announcer, she explains how she got over her childhood racism to love the man she was once told was a terrorist.
"I was a young Afrikaner girl whose views and mindset were changed by the greatest statesman of our time. Yet to me, he was more than my moral conscience. I had learned to care for him because he cared for me. He shaped and changed my thinking because for him to employ a white Afrikaans-speaking young woman as a personal assistant was not only unprecedented, it was unheard of."
Melt Myberg is the Afrikaans commissioning editor for Penguin South Africa, which published the book.
The book sends out a very important message in terms of Afrikaners and their place in the new South Africa. I think for many conservative Afrikaans speakers or even white English speakers in the country, the book kind of reminds us that there is a place for everybody in South Africa, and that is the way Nelson Mandela wanted it to be.
The bulk of the book focuses on Mr. Mandela's life after his presidential term ended in 1999. Lagrange paints an ugly picture of politics and family infighting. Neither the Mandela Foundation nor the government have issued public statements, but Myberg says that this book is not intended to be anything but one woman's recollections.
There are some issues that come out in the book that are quite contentious, or it proved to be contentious. But it's an honest book about Zelda's experience with Nelson Mandela.
Lagrange alleges that family power struggles and political interests compromised Nelson Mandela's health as factions battled to control the medical care the former president received. The memoir goes further, with Lagrange recalling how Mr. Mandela's wife, Graça Machel, was emotionally brutalised by one of his daughters and later sidelined on making decisions about Mr. Mandela. In fact, Lagrange says, Machel was forced to obtain a pass to attend Mr. Mandela's memorial service due to what Lagrange says was hostility from some family members. There were, of course, better times. In this red excerpt, Lagrange recounts a visit to London to see the Queen, whom Mandela always greeted as Elizabeth.
"I think he was one of the very few people who called her by her first name, and she seemed to be amused by it. When he was questioned one day by Mrs. Michelle and told that it was not proper to call the Queen by her first name, he responded, 'But she calls me Nelson.' On one occasion, when he saw her, he said, 'Oh, Elizabeth, you've lost weight.' Not something everybody gets to tell the Queen of England."
Some of the book's other anecdotes include dinner with the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, who was a staunch supporter of the African National Congress during the years of struggle against apartheid. Lagrange recollects how Mr. Mandela referred to this Bono chap, referring to the band U2's frontman. On meeting Brad Pitt, he asked the actor for his business card. Failing that, he asked Pitt what he did for a living. Zelda Lagrange's book may be no literary masterpiece, but it does offer a unique perspective on the liberation hero from close range. That alone makes the memoir stand out from the deluge of books on Mr. Mandela, released since his death in December 2013. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Looking for something? Headline news? Interviews, analysis, we've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN Refugee Agency says the death toll of migrants trying to reach Europe by crossing the Mediterranean continues to rise. This week, South Sudan marks its third year of independence. And two opposing rebel factions in the Central African Republic postpone preliminary talks. Coming up, music from Kenya. And in our feature segment, we will examine why Nigeria's two main political parties are blaming each other for the violent Boko Haram insurgency. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next.
Put your flags up in the sky. In the sky.
Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday, Yehias.
Sunny, I understand we have a big football match in Brazil this evening.
Big, big match this evening, Yehias. And joining us once again on The Voice of America to tell us about it is our football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sonny.
David, let's kick off in Belo Horizonte, north of Rio de Janeiro, where later Tuesday evening at 2000 GMT, Brazil will host Germany in the first semifinal at the Football World Cup. The Brazilians go into this match without their star striker, Neymar. What impact will that have on the Brazilians?
That's a very interesting question you've put, Sonny. It could have two effects. They could play for Neymar. In other words, his absence will inspire the team to either greater heights. Or they could be in a sort of sulk mode, which means that they're lamenting the fact that their star striker is absent, and that could affect their performance. I'm inclined to believe it will be the former. I think it will inspire the Brazilians. If nothing else, Sonny, the 11 men on the field want to prove that although Neymar is a star, he's not the only star in the Brazilian team, and even with his absence through that back injury sustained in the quarterfinal victory over Colombia, that Brazil can still do the trick. It's one of two fascinating Europe versus South America duels. If we look first at Brazil, they've reached the semifinal, Sonny, by winning three matches and drawing two. The Germans have a slightly better record. They've won four and drawn one. However, I would say the Brazilians have had a slightly tougher path, particularly in the knockout stages, those battles with Chile, which went to penalties, and with Colombia, which Brazil shaded 2-1, were probably a shade tougher than Germany's victory after extra time over Algeria, and then their reasonably comfortable quarterfinal victory over France. Now, of course, besides Neymar, who has obviously attracted all the media attention, the Brazilians are also going to be without their central defender, Thiago Silva. He is suspended. It could boil down, Sonny, to Neuer, the magnificent German goalkeeper, against the Brazilian attack, with the Germans obviously looking to catch the Brazilians on the counter. It's a really difficult one to call. I'm going to go narrowly towards Brazil. And the reason for that, Sonny, is largely the fact that they've got home advantage. I think if this semi-final was in Germany, I would be predicting a German victory, but as you said, it's in Belo Horizonte, there in Brazil, so we'll give the verdict to Brazil. But if Germany were to pull it off, it would not surprise me in the least. I think this is one that could easily go to extra time and possibly even that drama of all dramas, the penalty shootout.
David, this is a rematch of the 2002 World Cup final played in Yokohama, Japan. The Brazilians prevailed in that final 2-0. How do you compare this Brazilian team, David, to some of those great teams of the past?
I think, Sonny, they're not quite as good. I think this is a good Brazilian side. I wouldn't say at this stage, from the evidence I've seen, that they're a great side. They're certainly nothing like the team of 1970. I was very much a child at that stage. I was exactly 10 years old, but I'll never forget the Brazil of 1970. That's the team that went on to beat Italy 4-1 in the final. I think that team, Sonny, that included the likes of the great Pelé, Jairzinho, Castal, you know, the names just roll off my tongue, even though it was like 44 years ago. That was probably the greatest Brazilian team of all time. Now, casting my mind back to 2002 in the final in Japan, I think the Brazil team of today is roughly equal to that 2002 side. And interestingly, Sonny, the coach of that World Cup winning Brazilian side was none other than Scolari, who, of course, is the coach now. But the Germans, I think, are a better side now than the one in 2002. It's a great tribute to the Germans that if you look at their recent records, Sonny, 2002, they were runners-up. In 2006, as hosts, they finished third. And then 2010, in South Africa, they finished third. Even if they don't make the final, they'll be, of course, contesting the third-place playoff. So that's a final and three semifinals at least in the last four tournaments.
David, on Wednesday in Sao Paulo, also with a 2000 GMT kickoff, the Netherlands will play Argentina in the second World Cup semifinal. How's this match shaping up?
Yes, I mean, another fascinating Europe versus South America duel. Argentina are the only one of the semifinalists who have won all five matches so far. Netherlands, on the other hand, have won four matches and drawn one. And that drawn match, of course, was against those minnows from Costa Rica, who I suppose you could almost say are the moral champions of this World Cup, because nobody in their wildest dreams outside of Costa Rica would have expected this team to get so far. Not only did they hold the Netherlands for 90 minutes, they held them for a further 30 minutes of extra time. But then, sadly for them, in the penalty shootout, they had two spot kicks saved. But that was obviously a wake-up call for the Dutch. This one, Sonny, it's hard. I've written down here in front of me, Lionel Messi versus Van Gaal. Now, that may seem a little bit strange in that one is a footballer and the other is a coach. But look at Louis Van Gaal. Just before the end of extra time against Costa Rica, he did something that I cannot remember happening at a World Cup before. He substituted his goalkeeper, despite the fact that the goalkeeper had not done anything wrong. He had been rarely tested, admittedly, by the Costa Ricans, but had conceded no goals. Needless to say, the gamble paid off spectacularly because Krul, who came on, saved two spot kicks. And asked for an explanation afterwards, Van Gaal said, "Oh, but Krul is 2 inches taller than the goalkeeper he replaced." It just shows you how thorough some of these coaches are. I'd never realized World Cup strategy comes down to a couple of inches. It'll be interesting to know what plans he's got for Messi. Now, Messi, of course, as the Belgian coach, Wilmot, said, he is the extraordinary player in a very ordinary team. I think that's a little bit harsh. 5 wins in a row. No matter how good Messi is, he can't win 5 games in a row on his own. And I think Argentina are formidable semi-finalists. You have Messi on the one side, Sonny, and then on the other side, of course, you've got that dynamic duo, Robin and Van Persie. So another really difficult one to call. Again, I'm going to go with the fact that Argentina have basically got home advantage. Make no mistake about it, there's going to be an awful lot more Argentinian supporters in the stadium than there will be Dutch supporters. And that can be a factor. Once again, Sonny, I wouldn't be surprised with extra time. I would not be surprised either by penalties. But I'm sticking my neck out, and I'm going to go for the first South American World Cup final since 1950, Brazil against Argentina. And back in 1950, it was Brazil against Uruguay. So that would be the dream final, of course, for all South Americans. And for Europeans, well, they're obviously longing for Germany against the Netherlands, which would be a repeat of the 1974 final, in which Germany came back from conceding a first-minute goal to win 2-1. So, Sonny, with a little bit of hesitancy, I'm saying it's Brazil and Argentina Sunday in the final.
David, you mentioned Messi. With Neymar now out of the tournament, is this Messi's World Cup?
It could well be, Sonny. Good point. I think the final, if it was between Brazil and Argentina, the international media, of course, were going to label it Neymar versus Messi. And there's no doubt that the injury to Neymar, which has ruled him out of the rest of the tournament, has taken a little bit away from this tournament. But I don't think we must get fixated on one player. He was injured. He cannot play. The show must go on. And Messi, of course, Sonny, he's obviously still got his eye on the golden boot. Now, he's got 4 goals at the moment, but the leader with 6 goals is Rodriguez, I guess one of the finds of the tournament, the Colombian, who plays for Monaco in France. So there's a lot going for Messi still. He'd obviously like to win the golden boot. He'd also like to win the player of the tournament. Messi, for all his success with Barcelona, has not had the same level of success with his national team. So, yes, he is playing for an awful lot on a personal level and also for his team.
David, the Desert Foxes from Algeria were arguably the top-performing African team in Brazil. They put up a valiant effort against Germany in the knockout stages before losing in extra time, and they've now lost their Bosnian coach. VOA! Can you update our VOA World Cup fans?
Yes, Sonny. Sadly, in my opinion, Vahid Halilhodžić, a Bosnian who's also a French citizen, he's decided to quit the Algerian team. It didn't come as a surprise to me. I've mentioned several times on the Sonny Side of Sport that Halilhodžić has had an awful relationship with the Algerian media. The media have called him arrogant, they've called him flippant, and on the other hand, Halilhodžić has said that the media are unpatriotic. Well, I think Halilhodžić made his point at the World Cup. I couldn't agree more with you. I think Algeria were the African team in terms of performances. They fought through to the second round, and they gave Germany a really good fight for it. They took the Germans to 120 minutes, and this is a German side that, as we said earlier in the show, have an outstanding World Cup record. But Halilhodžić, I've met him a couple of times. He's a tough customer. He's not one to mess around with. For example, as a media person, you've got to make sure you ask him an intelligent question, or else he gives you that almighty stare and just goes blank. He will simply not answer what he terms a stupid question. But he's weighed up his options. The head of state in Algeria, the president of the country, pleaded with him to stay on to help the Desert Foxes grow from their World Cup campaign, but he has decided otherwise. And I suppose, Sonny, in time to come, we'll learn of his destination, and maybe something has already been fixed up. I think he's got his eyes on probably a top European club. Looking at his background, he has said on several occasions that he believes he's good enough as a coach to take a team to the UEFA Champions League title. It's quite a big boast to make, and perhaps he's now going to get an opportunity to fulfill that prediction.
Thanks, David. That's our football guru, David Legg, who's sticking his neck out and predicting a Brazil versus Argentina World Cup final on Sunday in Rio de Janeiro. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sonny Side of Sports. Back to you, Hayes Woohee.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sonny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sonny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. In our feature segment, Nigeria's two main political parties blame each other for the violent Boko Haram insurgency. And next, Brazil, receiving more students from Africa. But first, some music. Here is Miki Njaga of Kenya with Beautiful Wonderful.
Get to know you. It's wonderful. Get to know you.
Mickey Njaga of Kenya with Beautiful Wonderful. Politicians worldwide often vilify their opponents, and those in Nigeria are no different. As the 2015 elections approach, Nigeria's two main political parties are blaming each other for the violence Boko Haram insurgency in the north. As Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja, analysts say neither party is wholly to blame, but individual politicians from both parties could partially be funding the group.
In the past 5 years, Boko Haram militants have killed thousands of people, and as next year's elections draw near, the insurgency appears to be growing. More than 2,000 people have been killed this year alone in attacks on markets, military bases, bus stations, and even football viewing centers. In April, the Islamist radical group kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls. At his home in the Niger Delta, Avi Joseph, a local leader within the ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP, says the opposition funds the violence, trying to make the country ungovernable.
Where problems of kidnapping, Boko Haram, all that are coming, is a style of trying to destabilize the ruling party and its an opposition.
He says Boko Haram's increasing strength is evidence that wealthy politicians must be supporting the group. The opposition he speaks of is the All Progressive Congress, or APC, a mega party formed last year when several opposition parties merged. Analysts say if the party can stand behind a single candidate next year, it could prove to be a formidable opponent to the PDP, which has governed Nigeria since 1999. Christian Ononjacha is the assistant secretary of the APC in Delta State. He blames the ruling party for failing to stop the insurgency.
What they are now trying to do is to throw the blame on us that we are involved. But we are not involved. We are not in charge of the federal security apparatus. They are in charge.
He says the ruling party is wasting time pointing fingers when it should be fighting the insurgency. He concedes that individual politicians may be involved, but he thinks they are from the ruling party.
Our members are clean. They are people that we know can salvage this nation from the quagmire that it is currently.
But some analysts say that on this issue, both parties are correct and both are wrong. Jan St-Pierre, the CEO of Berlin-based security consulting firm Mosicon, says Nigerian politicians often hire thugs to intimidate their opposition.
Both sides use them depending on how greedy or ambitious the local politician was. They would sometimes use more of their services, sometimes less, but both sides, all parties were.
St-Pierre says the politicians may not be interested in Boko Haram's goals, but in northeastern Nigeria, the Boko Haram members happen to be the guys with the guns. The group is believed to be controlling villages along the Chad and Cameroon borders, he says. And in those areas, even conducting an election will require support from Boko Haram.
They intimidate, they terrorize. And when possible, they actually provide goods and services, which gives them the legitimacy that sometimes, despite everything that they're doing, that the government doesn't seem to have.
Boko Haram's name means Western education is sinful, and the group has threatened President Goodluck Jonathan by name. However, St-Pierre says while Boko Haram may be partially supported by a corrupt political system, the insurgents probably do not care who wins. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Brazil is not only a destination for soccer fans around the world. The emerging Latin American powerhouse is also becoming a destination for more students from Africa. From Brasilia, VOA's Nicolas Pinot looks at the trend and talks to three university students from the Republic of Congo.
Brazil is not only a dream destination for soccer fans from around the world, the emerging power also is receiving more and more students from Africa. From Brazil, VOA's Nicolas Pinot looks at the reasons behind the trend.
With almost 40,000 students, the University of Brasilia is an institution here. Among them are 100 or so Africans who came to try the Brazilian adventure. Most of them are from Angola or Cape Verde. But you also find some Francophones from Ivory Coast and Democratic Republic of Congo.
There are plus de structures pour étudiants. Il y a la bibliothèque.
Here you have more facilities for the students, like the library, many other things you do not have at University of Kinshasa. The Brazilian government also helps the students with grants, so we have better conditions here than in Congo.
These young people came to find opportunities. The United States or Europe are often inaccessible. Brazil, as an emerging power, is more appealing, even though Portuguese is the first language. To get a visa for Brazil, African students are obligated to return home after they graduate. This does not prevent them from fitting in.
They were colonized by the Portuguese, but they have many African roots. So it was very easy to feel integrated, make friends, learn the language. So I am okay, no problem.
Although this Brazilian adventure has many advantages, home sweet home is always on their minds, and they miss their families. They will spend several years without seeing them.
I miss Kinshasa so much. I've been here a year and a half. It's not easy with family to live far away from them, mommy and daddy. I miss them so much, even if we communicate with phone calls. But it is expensive.
Many swear they will go back home after their studies, with no guarantee that Africa will offer the same opportunities. But these young people want to succeed in their country and look at the future with an optimism they have found among Brazilians. Nicola Pino, VOA, Brasilia.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the words of Secretary of State John Kerry, we find perhaps no greater threat to human dignity, no greater assault on basic freedom, than the evil of human trafficking. Traffickers victimized more than 20 million people worldwide, netting approximately $150 billion in the private sector alone. With numbers like these, the struggle against modern slavery can seem daunting. In the 2014 Trafficking in Persons Report, the Department of State analyzed 188 countries and territories, including the United States, and ranked governments based on their efforts to fight modern slavery. All countries are placed into one of four tiers: those countries with governments that fully comply with the minimum standards to eliminate trafficking fall into Tier 1. Countries that do not comply but are making significant efforts to do so are Tier 2. The Tier 2 watch list includes countries that do not comply with the minimum standards and are making significant efforts, but failed to increase such efforts compared to the previous year. Finally, countries on Tier 3 do not comply with the minimum standards and are not making significant efforts to do so. The TIP report is an assessment tool that provides guidance and recommendations to governments on how to actively improve their response to human trafficking, particularly to protect victims. The State Department uses information from U.S. embassies, foreign government officials, non-governmental and international organizations, media reports, academic studies, and research trips to write the report. Governments should make comprehensive support services and structures available to survivors of human trafficking during the recovery process and as they rebuild their lives. The United States has recently taken action to further assist victims. In January, the U.S. government released a 5-year strategic action plan on services for victims of human trafficking in the United States. Yet there is more work to be done, which is why we welcome partnerships with civil society both in the public and private sector. As Secretary John Kerry said, the Trafficking in Persons Report is not just a book. It's not just a report filled with stories that will touch you. This is a call to action. It is a reminder of what happens in many dark places that need light. And we have a responsibility to try to bring that light to these individuals and to these places.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.